Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today. And we're going to have an interesting show. Going to be talking about money, specifically your money in the Federal Thrift Savings Plan, Uncle Sam's 401k plan, as which some people have described as a 401k plan on steroids because of the low administrative fees and the fact that for most investors, most people are under the Federal Employees Retirement System. The government will kick in up to 5% if you put in at least 5%. And that's is often been described as a tax-deferred 5% pay raise, and not a bad deal, and certainly better than most 401k plans in the private sector. My guest today is Arthur Stein. Arthur is an investment, a financial planner based in Bethesda, Maryland, and we'll give his identification numbers later on so you can reach him. But Arthur, thank you for making the trek down here.
Happy
to
be
Northwest
here, D.C.
Your background always fascinates me. You taught at a university in Australia, and I always get it wrong. I say Perth, and it's
no,
Brisbane.
It was Perth. Murdoch University in Perth, Australia.
And I was
in the Peace Corps as an economist for the government of Botswana in their Ministry of Finance, and then I was economist on the House Ways and Means Committee. And
so, boy, you have been there, done that, have several T-shirts,
yeah,
don't you? Very,
I got a lot of T-shirts.
Very interesting. Botswana, you know, from The Gods Must Be Crazy, right?
Yeah,
that Botswana.
Exactly. They must be crazy if they let me work there, is the way
yeah, that's
see
right.
It.
The country's never been the same. The Thrift Savings Plan had a very, very good year. And as you pointed out in your in the newsletter that you send out to your clients and followers and friends, the experts this time last year said that if we were lucky in 2013, the markets would go up 7 or 8%. In fact, they did much better than that, and the TSP funds are just out of sight. Could you run down those numbers?
Yeah, it was a great year for the stock funds. The C fund, which is large cap stocks, was up 32% for the year, and the S fund, which is small and mid cap stocks, was up 38%, and the I fund, the international stock fund, was up 22%. Now, on the negative side, the F fund, which is the bond fund, was down 1.7% per year. Of course, that includes reinvested interest. And this is something that, you know, might have been a shock to a lot of people that the F fund can go down, but it can. If interest rates continue to go up, we could see another decline this year. Historically, the F fund is relatively stable compared to the stock funds, but it still can go down in value. The G fund cannot go down in value. You know, whatever you get, you have it there forever. It was up 1.9%. And the TSP has not yet released the updated 3, 5, and 10-year averages. It's not coming out till I think next week. But what you're going to see is that over those longer periods of time, the stock funds solidly outperformed the G fund and the F fund. And, you know, historically, you know, based on the historical records, that's what we would expect over most long periods of time. Now, there's no guarantee that, you know, in the future that's going to continue, but historically there's stock funds have always done well if you own them long enough. And the question is, how long did you have to own them? Because, of course, you know, there are years where they go down quite a bit. Like, you know, 2008, I think it was down over 30%.
I had a friend who had been in the Clinton administration, then left and joined the oil industry, and then came back when President Obama was elected. So, you know, high-level job and a big thrift savings plan account and a big outside account. And during the recession, she became, like many people, became so nervous about the, you know, the heading downhill that she pulled all of her money out of the CS and I funds. I don't know how much that was, but it was presumably a lot, and put it in the G fund. And what I feared, I've never had the nerve to ask her since, was, is that she stayed in it. She stayed in the G fund. So she missed all of those good years. She's in fact sold low, right? And when she comes back, she'll be buying high.
Exactly. And this is a problem with trying to time the stock market or to try and time when you buy and sell various funds in the TSP is that even if you get out at a good time, which is very hard to do, it's very difficult to buy back in when the market bottoms out. I mean, just psychologically, it's extremely difficult. It's confusing to know when the bottom is. And, you know, just an easier way to deal with it is just stay invested in the stock funds and whatever proportion is appropriate to you, and take the hits and just stay in there and then get the gains when you come back. And, you know, market timing just has not worked. And, of course, with the TSP, they've limited how much market timing you can do. You can only make two inter-fund transfers per month. After that, the only transfer you can make is to go into the G fund. So it's not a great trading vehicle, and that's certainly not a good idea anyway for people to be doing with their retirement accounts.
Yeah, and back when people were trading almost every other day, it was even worse than day trading. It was like day and a half trading.
It was minute by minute trading.
Yeah.
I know people who were in and out, you know, in 15, yeah, 20 minutes. And
yeah, but the changes weren't made after a certain time. The changes weren't made until the next day.
I see what you're saying with the TSP.
Yeah, I mean, it was the worst of all worlds. You know, they weren't getting what they thought, and what they thought they should be doing wasn't very smart. By the way, our number here is 202-465-3080. 465-3080 if you have questions for Art Stein. Art, looking at why it was such a good year, and the most optimistic predicted 7 or 8% growth, Europe didn't collapse. You know, this time last year we were looking at rioting in the streets in Athens, major discontent in Spain. The Irish situation was very bleak. The Celtic tiger lost its fur and its stripes for a while. But all that seems to have – the euro didn't melt down.
Yeah, I mean, the euro didn't collapse, and basically the recovery has not been great, but it's been okay. We're seeing positive economic growth. We're seeing increases in home prices and auto sales. Consumer debt is down. People are spending a little more. They're a little more comfortable. And, of course, it's surprising the economy did as well as it did, considering that, you know, we had the sequestration. We had, you know, the government was closed down. None of this was good for confidence. None of this was good for the economy. But the other thing that I would point out, and I think it's an extremely important point that people need to remember, that the stock market is a leading indicator of economic activity. It tends to go up before the economy gets good, and it tends to start going down before the economy starts to go down. And so, for instance, one of the reasons that market timing is so hard and you'd be better just kind of staying in, we just had a 32 to 40% increase in the stock market, depending upon which index you're looking at. And that may indicate a great year in 2014 for the economy, but it doesn't mean that the market, stock market's going to necessarily go up anymore. Maybe you had 2 years worth of increases concentrated in 1 year, and if you missed out, you know, there's no getting that back.
Yeah. Well, in these cases where people are trying to time the market, what do you think about the life cycle funds, the L funds? And for people who don't know what they are, the L funds, there's an L present income, which means you're presumably retired now. There's an L2020, and that means you would be tapping your money on or about the year 2020. There's a 2030, 2040, and a 2050 fund.
Yeah. The L funds automatically rebalance your investments in the L fund every quarter. And if you get an L fund when it first comes out, and I think they come out every 10 years. There's currently an L2020, 2030, 2040, and 2050. And those are the years when they switch over to what's called the L income fund. And so what happens is when these funds first come out, they're 90% in the stock funds, C, S, and I. And over time, they become more conservative till they hit, you know, their year of maturity. It's not real maturity, but the year of maturity, then they turn into the L income fund, and the L income fund is extremely conservative. 74% in the G fund, 6% in F, and then the other 20% is in stocks, CS&I. So, you know, I mean, that's a nice way to slowly shift into bonds if that's what you think you want to do. However, for retirees, the mistake that I think a lot of people make with the L funds is they think I'm going to retire in, say, 2030. I'll get the L2030 fund.
Excuse me, you're about to use the I word, aren't you, for inflation?
Well, it's not only the I word for inflation, but they forget that, yeah, maybe they retire in 2030, but that doesn't mean they're going to take all their money out of the TSP and spend it in 2030.
We need to take a short break here, but let me ask you about that when we come back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. I'm sorry, she... Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He is a financial planner based in Bethesda, Maryland. Very interesting background. Worked on Capitol Hill for the House Ways and Means Committee, and did time with the Peace Corps in Botswana, and taught at the university in Australia in Perth, and now is come back here to frigid Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Been here for many years, well-known financial planner in the area. Arthur, you, before the commercial rudely interrupted us, we were talking about after you retire, you know, that's not the end of the line by a long shot. I saw an obituary in the Washington Post the other day, and I believe the woman retired in 1964.
Wow.
And I'm thinking that's most Americans weren't even born in 1964.
So she was 50 years retired.
Yeah. And that it happens. It can happen. And this is, I guess, to your point about not letting inflation eat into your savings, your TSP, and your annuity itself.
Yeah, and, you know, the problem I have with the L funds is sort of the academic studies indicate that if you've got a majority of your investments in bonds over long periods of time when you're retired, you're going to generate less money to live on and not more. And so the L funds are sort of automatically pushing you into a portfolio that's more conservative than your needs. And you could easily end up with less money as a result. I mean, I'm an investment manager, and one of the things I do for my clients who are federal employees and retirees is I also, you know, give advice to them on their TSP balances, not just the money they have invested with me. And so they don't need the L funds. We're just going to put together a portfolio and a portfolio balance that matches their needs. And really, even for a retiree, unless they're 90 or 95 or 100, you know, if they're 65, they should still have a majority of their investments in stocks and mutual funds and TSP funds that own stocks.
But a majority, you mean more than half?
Yeah, like 60% is
okay.
Good.
I have a friend who's retired from the government, retired early, but retired, and he has sort of done that, I think, to your strategy. He would normally be in the 2020 present income fund. But instead, he's put his money in the 2020 fund for the year 2020, meaning he has a lot more stocks in his portfolio and a smaller portion of bonds and the G fund. Is that a way to do it? Because Lauren Larson is our producer here. She's very young, very smart, and I'm always giving her advice, and she pretends to fall asleep, but I know she's secretly listening. She's listening even as we speak. For somebody like her, if you chose the L fund as a vehicle, pick the furthest out, the 2050?
Or you could just, you know, actually decide what would be an appropriate balance for your account. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's better to choose a fund that matures after you retire.
Yeah.
I guess, if you're not going to start spending the money when you first retire. But, you know, that's kind of a much more complicated situation that I don't like to generalize about, because as an investment manager, I give specific solutions to specific clients. But it seems to me to be dancing around the issue to get an L fund that matures long after you retire, because you know that otherwise it's going to be too conservative. why not just decide or work with a financial planner and investment manager who can help you decide what percentage you should have in the different funds?
You know, I can see that, but citing, going back to my friend who, in 2008, she became so nervous about the market that even though she's a very smart person, but even though she knew in her heart of hearts that we probably weren't in a second Great Depression and this would probably end, she literally couldn't sleep at night.
Yeah, no, I understand.
So I would think for her and for someone like that, probably for someone like me, an L fund would be good because they would make the corrections that I wouldn't have the nerve to make.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. I'm not trying to do an advertisement for myself. Why not go out and hire a financial planner who can help you make these decisions? I mean, you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, if you missed out on a 30% increase, that just cost you $30,000, $60,000, $90,000, $120,000 in potential gains. Why not pay an investment manager or financial planner to give you professional advice as to what you should do?
Better than your brother-in-law or the guy in the carpool.
Better than your brother-in-law, better than the person who is sitting next to you in the office. And, you know, the good thing about hiring somebody is that they're dealing with your specific situation, which is unique. And it may not be completely different from some other people, but everyone's going to have different needs. And one of the big differences is how much money are you going to need out of your investments when you first retire? How young are you when you first retire? You know, if you have a spouse, what kind of annuity or pension do they have? These things all make a big difference in how your money should be invested.
Yeah, okay. Now, 2013, we're talking about it being such a good year, better than most people expected. The other reasons were is that even though unemployment is still high, it's 7%, and I think nationally, and 8% or worse in some states, but it goes back to what you were saying, that maybe who was it? Was it Abraham Lincoln that said the good Lord must have loved the common people because he made so many of them? And it's from what you were saying earlier, it seems as if people sometimes are smarter than the markets, and they, when they start feeling good, good things happen. They make good things happen. And
yeah,
they get ahead
I mean,
of
I
it.
Think confidence is up a little bit, especially after the government came back to work. And actually, I got to say that I felt a lot better after Janet Yellen got appointed to the Federal Reserve Board because, you know, it just—
Much more of the same, huh?
It indicates some sanity coming back to Washington, D.C., and I think she's going to do a great job. But anyway, the economy had a good year. It was not a great year, but it was a good year. Unemployment is way too high, but it's down. You know, we're creating more jobs. People are spending more. And— you know, 2014 hopefully would be a good year, too. Now, a big part of the improvement in the economy was the Federal Reserve, you know, pumping up the economy by doing a program they called quantitative easing, where they're artificially keeping interest rates low. And they've now announced they're going to start cutting back on that. And we did see interest rates go up last year in anticipation of that and after the announcement. And because interest rates went up, existing bond prices go down. That's why the F fund had a negative year. And that could happen again, and maybe, you know, the increase in interest rates will slow the economy a little bit. I don't happen to think so, because I think if that starts to happen, the Fed isn't going to cut back as quickly.
Well, the you know, a number of things happened, a number of things didn't happen, but with sequestration, you know, by the time it was upon us, the smart money was saying it can't happen. It's like a Dr. Strangelove doomsday machine. Nobody would let it happen. Then when it was about to happen, people predicted the end of civilization as we know it, and I'm sure we did it here too, although we try to restrain ourselves. And as it turned out, the Republic survived. It continued, and most people, and now there are many that were hurt by it. I know contractors who didn't get paid for a couple of days, and people whose jobs were in jeopardy, and particularly in areas like the Washington area, which is so dependent on the government. But by and large, it just sort of rolled on, and people, either out of ignorance or great wisdom, just seemed to shrug it off.
Yeah, and I think the sequestration that's not good government. It's silly government. And it just shows you how bad things are in D.C. But overall, it wasn't a huge negative for the economy. I think the really negative effects, you know, we're not seeing. It's like fewer FBI investigations, you know, an aircraft carrier that's not in the Persian Gulf when it normally was. And I just think we look a little silly to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're not trying to get in that political thing, but as far as the economy was concerned, it's a bit of a drag on the economy when the government spends less, but sequestration was not a huge hit to the economy.
You know, back to the L funds for a minute, the life cycle funds, and I agree with you that, by the way, I think if the probably the smart money is get a good emphasis on good financial planner, that maybe the one that doesn't necessarily sell their own stocks, but they just individual advice. When people come to you, your clients, how does that work? Do they come? I mean, can they call you anytime?
Yeah, I mean, my clients can,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not running 24/7, but for my investment management clients, I mean, I also give advice on, you know, just their general economic picture, you know, should they refinance their mortgage, things like that. But I monitor their investments. I make recommendations. We review them quarterly, frequently talk more often than that. And I don't it's fee-based investing, so I get a percentage. So the more their investments go up, the better I do, the better they do.
Yeah, so you have, in addition to loving them, you have a vested interest in
them.
Yeah. Short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with Arthur Stein. He is a financial planner based in Bethesda. Art, would you give us your call signs and how people can reach you?
My website is ArthurSteinFinancial.com, ArthurStein, Financial.com, all one word, no dots or anything. And my email address is art@ArthurSteinFinancial.com.
Got an email from someone about the Roth option, which we haven't touched on, and I know a lot of people are interested in it. Said, I've been fortunate to get on the right side of the growth curve since I started in the TSP. In the 90s and throughout the decade, I had most of my money in the CS&I funds and watched them grow. Around 2000, I cashed the majority of my growth in these funds and put them in the relatively safe G and F funds. I diversified my holdings throughout the last several years as my TSP value has slowly risen. I applauded and quickly moved into the Roth option instead of the regular 401k when it became available. Now, as I'm anticipating retirement, I find out the TSP will give you your money from a combined fund. That is, if you have 90% of your money in the traditional TSP, the 401k plan, and 10% in the Roth option, then that is how you get your money. According to TSP, they are required to do this by law, even though they show you Roth and regular 401k separately. TSP claims that they have do not establish a separate Roth account for you, so that is why they do it the way they do. What does that mean?
Okay, so first of all, let's say the Roth option in the TSP compared to the regular TSP. The money you contribute to the TSP, the regular TSP, the one that's been around for a long time, if you put in $12,000 during the year, it reduces your taxable income by $12,000. And when you take the money out, all the money you take out is taxable income the year that you take it out. And, you know, that's an excellent tax deferral is great. The Roth option is this. The money that you put in, and this is not the government contribution, you can put the money you can put in the Roth TSP option is only your contribution. And then the government contribution just goes into the regular TSP. But the money you put in there, it's not tax deductible when you put it in. So if you put in $12,000, it doesn't reduce your taxable income $12,000. But years later, really probably many, many decades later, when you take the money out, you don't pay any tax on the money that you take out. So, you know, the money, the $12,000 you might put in the Roth last year, maybe when you get around, you know, if it's 30 or 40 years later, it might be worth $30,000 or $40,000, and that's going to be tax-free when you take it out. So you're passing up a deferral, a tax deduction on a smaller amount now when you make your contribution for a tax-free withdrawal much later. Now, what that email refers to is, let's say you have, when you're retired, you have 90% of your money in the regular TSP and 10% of the Roth, and you want to take out $10,000. They're going to send you $9,000 from the regular TSP. It's pro rata. So $9,000 from the regular TSP, you pay tax on that, and you get $1,000 from the Roth TSP, which is non-taxable. And, you know, he's not happy because he'd like the option to be able to take all of his withdrawal from either the taxable traditional TSP account or maybe all of it from the non-taxable withdrawal Roth account. And I certainly, you know, that would be a nice bit of flexibility. You can do some financial planning based upon that. But I think the TSP feels they're trying to keep it simple. They're trying to keep the management fees down. I understand that. And the other thing is, if you're in that situation, that might be a time when you transfer the money you have either in the Roth TSP or the regular TSP into an IRA. Then you can withdraw the money from the IRA, and it doesn't affect your TSP.
Okay, I understand that. I talked with the TSP people about this, and they said they saw his point that when they started this thing, just allowing a Roth option was a big deal, you know, period. But it's a lot more work for them. They have to keep two separate sets of books and keep track of this account and that account, two accounts for you. And they said they would be looking at it later on.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons the TSP, Mike, is so successful is it hasn't tried to be everything to everybody. Yeah. They've kept it simple. It's only got five funds plus the L funds, which are composed of the five funds. I've seen 401ks that had 30, 40 funds in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they limit the amount of trading you can do among the funds. Not all 401ks do that. They've been very successful because they've kept costs down. And by not having as many choices, they made it less confusing for people. And that turns out to be an advantage.
That's my entree to do name dropping. Several years ago, Francis Rose and I of the station interviewed John Bogle, you know, the founder of the index fund and Vanguard and all that. And, you know, he's like Warren Buffett. He's in that pantheon of investment deities. And he said he would give anything if he could get into the thrift savings plan. He cited its administrative fees, which are half again as low as Vanguard, which at that time had the lowest in the business. And he just said, this is great. And then the relatively small number of options they have still covers everything.
Yeah.
You know,
the one thing I would say, you know, the TSP is great, but if you actually compare management costs between Vanguard, say their S&P 500 index fund to the C fund, it's about a tenth of a percent per year difference. You know, it's not really a huge difference.
Yeah.
But still, there are a lot of 401ks that use very expensive funds, you know, where there are a lot of fees. And the TSP is not one of them. And this thing with the Roth, okay, it's not perfect. But the Roth option is a great option for people. I especially like it for younger people.
Very good. Arthur, would you give your call signs again?
It's website is arthursteinfinancial.com. I have a blog on that website. I try and blog some about once a month. And also, if you want to sign up for my newsletter, you can do it there. And my email is art@arthursteinfinancial.com.
Very good. Well, thanks for coming in. And stick with us, folks. We're going to be talking with Andy Medici and Nicole Blake Johnson from the Federal Times, and they are going to bring us up to date on what's coming down the road for you. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and we're talking with Arthur Stein before. And remember that all our shows are archived here on our homepage, so you can listen to them anytime if you want to make a reference to something or tell a friend about it. We love it. Want to know that you're listening later on at your leisure. I'm going to be talking now with Andy Medici and Nicole Blake Johnson from the Federal Times. we'll take a look at what happened last year, which is obligatory in our business this time of year, what's coming up ahead. And Nicole, first off the bat, A, welcome to the show, and B, what's going on in the IT world and government?
Well, first off, thank you for having me.
Yes.
I've been focusing now more so on defense IT, and so I've been keeping an eye on what's happening within DoD. Specifically this month, we're all awaiting news on the rollout of software to manage their mobile devices, specifically Apple devices and Android devices. And so it's supposed to be stood up in an initial capability. Over the rest of this year, about 100,000 devices are supposed to be centrally managing, so keeping an eye on that. As well as in June, there's a deadline coming up for cloud computing vendors to have their capabilities approved by the government in terms of meeting certain security standards, so we're all kind of, you know, awaiting those deadlines.
Are these cloud people, are they competing against each other, or are they just competing to get into the government market?
Well, both in a sense. Uh-huh. First off, to get in the government, now there's about 298 security controls or requirements that they have to prove that they can meet. And, of course, those that can show early on that they meet those standards, the chances of them getting federal business are much higher than those who haven't met those standards.
Okay, because I keep seeing in your paper and our publication and others that different firms are contesting bids and they seem to be lawsuit happy now.
Well, Mike, if you don't mind,
yes.
Bid protests did drop a little bit last
they
year.
They did,
but
okay.
At the same time, they are high in number, mostly because it's not the number of bid protests that are upheld by GAO. About 40% of bid protests are actually settled out by the agency and the company. So, you know, if you're a company and you want something, if you protest, you might get something back from the agency. So, you know, companies really are aware of that, and they like to press their advantage when they can.
Hey, I wanted to ask both of you, we spent much of the year worrying about sequestration and furloughs and changes in benefits and the chained CPI that would reduce future cost of living adjustments for federal retirees, military retirees, and people who get Social Security. All of these things that were about to happen, and then suddenly the year is over. None of them happened. The sequestration came and went, but none of the dire predictions we had heard seemed to happen, and Feds wound up with a 1% pay raise. Did I miss something?
Well, I think there was a long, bumpy ride there. No, I don't think you're missing anything. I think what we saw is that Congress is poised at any moment to do something, but at the end of the day, they actually have to do it. And what it all came down to is that, you know, at the end of the year, employees got that 1% raise, and, you know, they offset a little bit of about a third of the sequestration cuts, and they hit some other areas for a little bit of money instead of federal workers. So at the end of the day, all of that could have happened, of course, up until the moment that it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, without being overly cute, we all complained about Congress being on vacation so much. They call it a back home district work period, but they were on vacation a lot, and they were away a lot. And when they were here, they were fighting and not doing a lot. But at least as far as federal workers are concerned, maybe not as citizens or taxpayers, but as federal workers, that may be a good thing.
Right. Sometimes inaction can be the best for a federal worker, especially when it seems most of the proposals are negative.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what are you guys working on now?
Well, one thing my colleague had wrote actually before the winter break was an interesting report that EEOC put out looking at obstacles that women face in the federal workplace. And I definitely thought it was noting and timely considering a lot of the changes going on, recent announcement of, you know, GSA, some senior officials leaving, all who happen to be women. And some interesting things that it noted, first off, looking at one of the obstacles being women trying to balance work and home life, especially when some of the agency policies, you know, don't provide leeway for them to do so, as well as you know, women who work part-time or take advantage of their flexible work arrangements, they're often considered less committed to their jobs than full-time employees. And one I found interesting was the fact that women are less likely to be invited to networking events or get the kind of training and development assignments that, you know, would prepare them for senior positions. So I thought that was something notable that, you know, we'd been looking at and working on last month.
That's interesting you'd say that. I was with an outfit one time, and somehow the upper management people and those who were tapped for upper management got into paintball games. So we could all go out in the woods and shoot at each other, you know, like healthy American boys. And it was all guys. And I found out later that the women, one or two were invited, but by and large it was a male thing. And it's the sort of thing we didn't notice at the time, but I can see in retrospect that was pulling them out of a major chance to network.
Very interesting you mentioned that. And I wonder what time of the day that event was.
Because
one of the recommendations was that networking opportunities and events should be held during work hours.
Yeah.
In order to allow women, you know, who have caregiving responsibilities to attend those events. So I wonder what time of the day that
is. Yeah, I think they were during work hours, but it was for the select few. Well, I interviewed a director of OPM years back, and she was one of the first women to be appointed to that slot. And she had worked at the Office of Management and Budget beforehand, and she said they frequently have late meetings, and she would just stand up at 7 o'clock, which is pretty late, and say, "Gentlemen, excuse me, my children are hungry," and she would go home and feed them. And she obviously made the big time, but for many women, that's a major problem, I would think.
Exactly right, to the point that, you know, balancing work and home life is definitely challenging, especially when you do have those responsibilities of, you know, caring for home, and at the same time you're, you know, making progress in your career and trying to move up the ladder. So having to balance the two is definitely a challenge.
I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's a little bit different between government and the private sector, because in the private sector, the last numbers I saw showed that men and women doing the same jobs, roughly the same jobs, men still made more. But in the government, a GS-10 is a GS-10, regardless of who occupies it. Is that correct?
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that. This report did point out that there were some gaps in pay, obviously, between you know, men and women. And one of the stats that the report cited was that women made up almost, you know, 44% of the federal workforce in 2011, but they held just 30% of senior executive service jobs and only 38% of GS-14 and GS-15 positions.
Yeah, okay, the numbers don't lie. Andy, what do you think is the possibility that this chained CPI, which is, and maybe you could explain it, which federal unions and national active and retired federal employees, all of them agree this is probably the biggest threat facing the federal workers and federal retirement system. What do you think of the odds of the CPI, chained CPI, happening, since both the administration and key members of Congress support it?
Well, I there's a difference between support and actually enacting legislation to get it done. And as we saw in 2013, that didn't quite happen. I think, you know, they got a bite out of some retirement contributions for future employees. You know, they're going to keep returning to CPI always as a small chip. Whether it actually passes is going to be hard. You know, Steny Hoyer has, you know, fought against that, and from, you know, members of the Congress from Maryland. You know, there is a lot of support for sort of shaving back benefits. And, of course, the chained CPI is just a different way of measuring the inflation and benefits. Of course, it just happens to be a lower estimate for those sorts of things. So, you know, it will keep coming back. I think we'll always hear about it. But so far, it seems that even though people have pushed for it, it hasn't made its way into the right legislation and hasn't gotten the right support. So, you know, once again, congressional inaction on this could be the saving grace for federal employees.
Question for both of you. Members of Congress are no longer covered by the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and a lot of their staff people are also out of it and have to go into one of these D.C. exchanges. I understand many of them are not happy about it. The fact that they've been linked to the federal program all these years hasn't hurt one bit. Whenever anything has been done to the federal health program, it's made it better. The guaranteed government contribution, the 70%+ year after year after year, no matter how much premiums go up. Do you think this delinkage, but the Congress now going its own way, could hurt the federal health program in the long run?
You mean that the fact that if members of Congress can't get it, will they feel less inclined to protect it in the future?
Exactly.
You know, I think this is one of those things where a lot of members of Congress and their staffs, they might have taken something for granted. And, of course, when the Affordable Care Act first passed, that measure to push them into the exchanges was included sort of as a gotcha amendment. But, of course, it went through, and now they're they're forced to be in the exchanges, but of course they still get the contributions, which is what there's sort of an argument going on about whether they should get the contributions, but it's about 3/4 of what they would pay is, you know, contributed by the employer. So they're still, in a way, they're still attached to the system, but at the same time, you know, I don't think it will make it more vulnerable. I think you might end up seeing at some point a sort of compromise so that Congress gets, you know, congressional staffers get some of what's going on in the federal workforce. And, of course, you know, federal employees will hopefully still keep fighting against it as hard as they've always been.
I know some people have implied that guaranteeing that the government contribution for the members of Congress and the staff at around 70% was actually kind of a bribe, if you will, to get them to go along with leaving the program.
Well, you know, staffers, they don't make a ton of money, and it's hard to imagine the people working for you being very happy if they have to shoulder 100% of that themselves. So, you know, that 70% probably did go a long way towards sort of sweetening that.
All right. Listen, Annie, Nicole, thank you so much for being with us. We'll talk to you guys maybe next week. Meanwhile, everybody else have a good week. Buckle up, be safe.
Thank you.